Hey everyone, this is Derek Burrows with the Conscious Resistance Network and Freethinker Radio on 90.1 KPFT Houston. Today I'm bringing you another important interview that I hope you guys will really just stay tuned and listen to every detail that we go over and do some homework on your own afterwards. We're going to leave you with lots of information. I know the guest today is going to have a lot to share, some of which might be familiar to my audience, most of which I would say is American or Western European, but much of which I think is going to be very new to you guys because I've focused on Epstein and the Finders and some of the things that have happened here in the United States. But Sonia, who we're about to speak to, has done a great job of covering what's happened on the other side of our brothers and sisters in the UK and in Europe and what we're dealing with over there. And surprise, surprise, much of the same problems across the pond. But how are you doing today, Sonia?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Derek. Thank you for, inviting me.
Yeah, I appreciate, just all the things that I've seen you up to. And some of you may have seen recently, I was actually talking with Sonia and Sean Atwood on his channel on Brand New Tube, and we were covering some of my work related to Bill Gates. So now we're switching roles today so we can get to hear about what you do. And I'm familiar with a bit of your work, but for my audience who might not be familiar with you and your channels, of course, we'll link everything below. But tell us a little bit about how you got into journalism and your work in general, what, your films and what you focused on over the years.
Great, thank you. Well, I began in journalism towards the end of the 80s. I started actually work as an editorial assistant, making coffee, opening posts, that sort of thing for local newspapers in central London, 16 central and local newspapers. But within 6 months, the editor took me under his wing and basically guided me. And he started letting me oversee the entertainments page. And music is my love. I come from a musical family. I can't play an instrument. And you know that old thing of those who can't do it, they teach it. Well, I started music journalism was an area that I was very interested in. And after I'd finished working at the local newspaper, I was then sort of headhunted to set up this new music industry, what they called the new music industry Bible. It was called Miro Music Industry Research organization. It was a subscription only monthly publication that was sent out to the music industry about who was recording where, who was touring where, that sort of thing. So I helped set that up. I said I'd only be there for a year because I wanted to learn about journalism. I didn't have a great educational background. I'd been orphaned at the age of 11. So it was quite difficult throughout my teen years and education wasn't really a priority. Survival more was. And so after I'd been at Miro for a year, I then saw an advert for a job for a black music publication called Echoes, which covered black music and black culture. And I loved hip hop. I absolutely loved hip hop, old school hip hop, which was quite unusual for a white female from the West Country in England when hip hop was really only just kind of starting. It was obviously coming out of New York and we were hearing about it and, breakdancing and all of that. But I just loved it. So I started writing about it. And over the next 12 years, I was in New York almost once a month for 10 to 12 years, which was quite phenomenal. I toured with some of the greats, Snoop Dogg, The Notorious Big, P. Diddy, Public Enemy, I mean, you name it, Jungle Brothers, Tribe Called Quest, like the brilliant, brilliant, brilliant old school hip hop, proper hip hop. And they schooled me. They actually schooled me. Once people accepted me, there was a lot of barriers about the idea that I, as a white person, wanted to write about black music and black culture, quite naturally, because it's always been the same old thing where white people have come in, they've taken over these cultures, certainly with black culture and black music. And there was a lot of, suspicion about who I was and what I was about. And I had to basically tough it through. And some artists refused to be interviewed by me to begin with. But after a while, they realized that I was legitimate, that actually what I wanted to do was break down the bigotry that these black artists were facing in the British media and in the British press. And so then by that point, Chuck D was, trusting me, invited me to their place in Long Island. And so then, word whipped around, she's safe, you can trust her. And in fact, when it came to Mary J. Blige, as one example, she refused to be interviewed at one stage by any member of the British press except me, because they knew I wasn't a hack, that I wasn't there to stiff them up, to find something that would pull them down. I wanted to shed light on why this music form at times was so hostile, so appeared so broken. And it was obviously because it was a reflection of the community that these artists were talking about. And I wanted to sort of translate that for the British public. At the same time, huge hip hop scene was growing in the UK. Kiss FM, which was just had just become legal in the 1990s. I began working on Kiss FM on a report called Street Knowledge. Every week I talked about, you know, my hip hop exploits, what I was doing, who I was covering, etc. Did that for 5 years. And then when my daughter was born in 1997, I realized I couldn't continue being a music journalist. I tried initially. I'd take her out to interviews with me, but it wasn't possible. I was a hands-on mum. I didn't want her to be on the road. I wanted her to have the stability of being at home. So I looked around about what else I should be covering. And it was all in the same vein, Derek, because where I'm coming from very much a sort of working class, underclass background. As I say, you know, my father left when I was 3, my mum died when I was 11. We were raised on welfare. I never wanted to lose sight of my roots. It was really important to me to always maintain that. And so on paper these days, I'm very middle class, but my heart isn't. My heart is still where I'm coming from. You know, quite a rough background, no shame at all to it. But I wanted to see how I could continue my journalism. And so I'd gone from hip hop, which was looking at the underdog, you know, racism, what was happening to people living in poverty. And so then I started to look more at social conditions. And that was it. A whole world opened up for me. Obviously, the injustices in the world, whether that was, well, whatever, the sexualization of children, issues with vaccinations, poverty, imbalance, you name it, anything to do with injustices. And I think probably since about 1997, which was when my daughter was born and when my music journalism was starting to come to an end, I think I've probably covered most issues of injustice now, you know. I mean, most, you know, whether that is, which we're going to talk about them, when I started to branch out into making documentaries, for example, the paedophile problem that we have in the UK, which, as you say, a lot of the stuff I cover is not just isolated to the UK. It absolutely is the same in the States. And in fact, some of the people that I've covered in the documentaries and the work that I do absolutely overlaps with what's going on in the States. And that is, in fact, how you first came on my radar, because I became aware of certainly one of your Epstein documentaries. I was like, hey, this guy knows something. And it was very much crossing over with what I was starting to understand with what was going on as well.
Yeah, that's a really amazing story. I didn't know that about you as far as your background in the hip hop journalism. I knew you've been involved in journalism for a while. So that's a really great story. I appreciate you sharing that with us.
Thank you. And
you're right. Like, it's the same pursuit, right? Of truth, whether it's the pursuit of truth about hip hop culture and where that comes from, or the pursuit of truth about any other topic in journalism, at least real investigative journalism, which to me, all journalism should be asking and answering questions. But clearly, as we know, that's not what a lot of people consider journalism these days. But it's been great to see that. And then to catch up kind of with your channel, you mentioned, you know, of course, the documentary films. I do want to talk to you about Pedophiles in Parliament. But before we get into that, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the other work you've done? I know you mentioned just vaccines a moment ago, both in your documentary films and just in your reporting. Other issues before we get into the pedophilia issue that are important to you.
Absolutely. Well, one of the big issues that I covered, and in fact, I'm a contributing editor at one of our major news organizations, because I do still work in mainstream media, because the platform is so huge. I'm not a compromised journalist. I go on these platforms, I'll be a talking head, but it's my words. Simple as that. I don't allow myself to be edited in any way. It's either you either accept me full or don't at all. But I am absolutely aware that mainstream media is a huge platform. And this is one example of where mainstream really worked. It must have been about 5-6 years ago, this man came to me and said, are you aware of the contaminated blood scandal? Well, that blew my mind, this idea that people were actually had been knowingly given contaminated blood. I couldn't get my head around it. I said, this can't possibly be right. As corrupt as I know politicians are, and the health service and big pharma, I still couldn't get my head around this. Anyway, the more I looked into it, the more I realized this wasn't only the truth, but this has been happening worldwide. And what was actually happening was that the Conservative government had imported blood from America, which had been from drug addicts, from people on Skid Row, all over, and it was contaminated. You know, there was a great deal of problems with this blood, and gave people, obviously, lifelong sicknesses and illnesses. And so I thought, what can we do about this? And so we went to David Cameron's constituency, who was Prime Minister at the time. And there was a meeting organised by people who were campaigning against contaminated blood. And I went with a camera crew. And David Cameron had agreed to meet them. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, he changed his mind on that afternoon. And it was the devastation that really upset me. I mean, these were people who were literally, they had been handed a life sentence, and all they wanted was a prearranged meeting with the then Prime Minister, which he then decided to cancel, which I suspect it was because it was a little bit, there was a little bit of a media attention. Anyway, the person who was leading it, Glenn, was so dispirited. I said, what would you like to do? He said, I would like David Cameron to have all this paperwork. And I said, well, we're going to his house. He said, well, when? I said, now. And so we jumped in the car because his constituency was quite close to his house. And we went to David Cameron's house. It's like going to Donald Trump's house, really. You know, quite similar, same thing. Armed guards around it. And I went with Glenn and our cameraman. And we had all these documents which outlined all of these people who were dying with contaminated blood. And I said to these two armed guards, and it was a country lane. They could have done anything with us because it was just me and the cameraman and Glenn and his wife and armed guards. And they had big rifles. And I just said to them, we want to leave this for David Cameron. They said, we can't permit you to do that. And I said, well, you're not going to stop me. This man is sick and he needs his case heard before anything further should happen to him. I was very aware that a lot of the people there that day, they had short periods to live. And I just felt that they just needed to be acknowledged. It made me so upset. Anyway, the armed guard said, you can't do that, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, just watch us. And we did. We actually shoved all the paperwork under David Cameron's front door and we filmed it all. It's all online. And Glenn grew. He physically grew in front of me. It was like his heart expanded. It was like, it was just like a spiritual moment. And I went back to producer I work with at ITN, and I said about it, and that was it, that we started covering it, that we got the inquiry. People started finally being awarded compensation for what they'd endured. And it wasn't the money that people were after. They needed acknowledgement, because apart from anything else, they needed proper healthcare. They needed proper healthcare, and that was all being denied to them. So there's an ongoing inquiry now. So that was one of the first things that really made me see the importance of my work. And that was really in only recent times. I mean, that was, I've done loads of stuff like that now to do with forced adoption. But the other story, which is very big to me and really important because it's about so much more than it appears on the surface, and that is the disappearance of Madeleine McCann. It's, you know, it's an international story. I've been covering that story right from the beginning. Obviously, Madeleine was a British child who was reported missing May the 3rd, 2007, while on holiday in Portugal with her two doctor parents and their friends, so named the Tapas Nine. Out of the nine of them, six of them were doctors. The official story was that they arrived on the Saturday, and from the Sunday onwards to the Thursday, when Madeleine was reported missing, every night the parents went out and left their toddler children. Well, they went to the tapas bar, and the official narrative was that Madeleine was kidnapped on the Thursday night when they were at the tapas bar. Well, I had a problem with this story right from the beginning, Derek. The official narrative just didn't add up to me. And apart from anything else, I know the British media. If this had been a black single mother living in a tower block who had been reported to go out night after night and leave her children alone, she would have been savaged and castigated by the British press. But Kate and Jerry McCann were held up as examples of society when they went on holiday with three children and only came back with two. So something was really wrong for me, because it showed the British snobbishness that you can get away with things if you've come from the right background, if you're white, if you're middle class, if you went to public schools, if you're doctors. And this is not to make any allegations against the McCanns. This is saying that they were given this almost free run to carry on, while other parents in that position would have been, you know, people would have drilled down on their story much more. And so that's been quite a major story for me over the years. I've made two documentaries about it. I've been in so much trouble. I've had legal threats. I've been dropped from programs of where the producers are friends of the McCanns. I've been warned off of the story. I was told by one producer that was one story that I don't cover, which the signal to me was that's one story you must cover. So, you know, because the moment that anybody tells me I shouldn't look at something, I get an alert in my head, which gives me a double reason to look at it. And the McCann story was that. And as I say, it's about so much more than a missing child. It is about censorship. It is about the capture of all of our DNA, which Tony Blair, who was in government at the time, was pushing for. And they used it. With 28 days after Madeleine was reported missing, Gordon Brown became Prime Minister. He put in a series of private calls to Kate and Jerry McCann, which again was extraordinary. When one child goes missing every 5 minutes, they certainly don't those parents certainly don't receive private calls from prime ministers. So that all of this was extraordinary to me. The influence of the McCanns, the fact that the story was portrayed in a certain way, the fact that Madeleine, no disrespect to her whatsoever, but Madeleine appeared to be much more important than a million other black or brown children who had gone missing. And all of this really disturbed me and triggered all that kind of underdog feeling that I have about the way the world is. And so that's a story that I've pursued at great length, really. Obviously, it's an ongoing case. We have to be careful what we say. There are now three police forces which are looking into it. Most recently, the German police claim that they have the man who took Madeleine, a man called Christian Bruckner, who's currently in prison in Germany. A horrible, unsavory character. He's been responsible for rape. He's got a history of paedophile allegations. He lived in Portugal. But I'll put money on it that that is not the man involved in the disappearance of Madeleine McCann. He is somebody that they want to fit the crime to. There is no doubt about it. And it's just not panning out for them.
Wow, so much great work, Sonia. And the first story you're talking about with the contaminated blood, I just want to kind of point to that from the reason I appreciate that story, obviously the desire to use journalism to try to help people who are in need, because that's essentially what it's about, right? Is giving people a voice who don't have a voice, who feel like they're being ignored, and being able, the best journalism I feel like is when we're able to use our craft to give people Absolutely. That voice, give them an opportunity to be heard. And a lot of times it's not always the, flashy, dramatic stories that people are looking for, the Madeleine McCanns, the Epsteins. There's things like that that are just affecting somebody on a local level. And, you know, those things don't make the front page. Again, people aren't really watching those YouTube videos for 10 millions of views. Right. But they're just as important, if not more important, because those are people who are, you know, they're trying to just live in the day-to-day process. And
Absolutely.
A lot of times that's not like a big sexy headline. It's just something that somebody needs help. And I appreciate that for sure.
Absolutely. Our job is, I absolutely consider our job to be the raising up of voices that don't have platforms. I absolutely consider that an integral part of what we do. Not just holding power to account, but making sure voices that go unheard are finally heard. I absolutely see that as part of my remit without a shadow of a doubt.
Great. And so the other one I want to mention or ask before we get to, we're getting towards pedophiles in Parliament. You just got so much good work to comment
Thank
on
you.
Here. When it comes to the Madeleine McCann case, so I've seen some of your work on that. I've watched some other things. I wouldn't consider myself to be the most informed on the entirety of it. But as you said, there's clear examples where, okay, these things don't add up. One question that comes to mind that I think you might be able to either, let's say, debunk or say you think there's something worth looking into is I've seen this floated online, and in my mind, it hasn't come from the most credible sources.
I think I know where you're going with this. Go on.
Okay. People trying to say that John Podesta is connected
yes.
to it. Okay, so yeah, what do you think about those claims?
I've not ever found a route to that, a source to that. The only thing that I've been able to find, because one of the claims is that he was in Portugal, staying at Clement Freud's villa at the time that Madeleine was reported missing. Now, we know, I don't know if you're familiar with Clement Freud. Clement Freud is part of the Freud dynasty. His, I think it was his grandfather who was Sigmund Freud. And in England, the Freuds actually have a huge amount of sway. But Clement Freud was a former politician, author, TV presenter, et cetera, has since been accused quite extensively of being a paedophile. He's dead now. But the McCanns became friends with him. He lived in Prague, Deleuze. He had a villa there. He invited them over. And the rumour about the Podestas was that the Podestas were staying at Clement Freud's villa. And so that they were there. Certainly John was there during the time that Madeleine was reported missing. Well, I've never, ever been able to source that ever. What I found was it said about that Sussex police had some information about this. A number of different police forces around the UK. Well, I've been to every one of those police forces that have been mentioned in blogs. None of them been able to verify that the Podestas were there, which doesn't mean they weren't. And I've always said this. I've always said, my mind is open. You bring me information, I will follow it up, always. Because I think that's the important thing about what we do, Derek, is always being prepared to expand our mind. Just because we've reached a conclusion on Monday, I'm open to changing my mind on Tuesday if somebody brings me evidence and information that, you know, is undisputable and can be followed up. Absolutely, my mind is always open to that. But what I found with the Podesta stuff is obviously there were the links to the WikiLeaks emails. There was the suggestion that he had said in there that he was in Portugal at the time. And the only thing I've ever been able to trace for this is a blog that where a lot of this information seemed to emanate from. And you know how it works, is that some, I mean, Chinese whispers. I mean, that, and that's really what happens, isn't it? Although that's probably a horrendously outdated expression now, thinking about it. But you know what I'm saying is how people, you know, apply and add something each time they receive a piece of information. And I think that's what happened with the Podestas. And the reason that I object to the Podesta rumor is because, one, I have never ever been able to find information to validate it, but more importantly for me is that I've looked into the case so much that I am absolutely of the mind that the people there, the Tapas Nine, know what happened. And I worry when we keep looking outside of there, because it helps the distraction, doesn't it, when we're looking, because the Tapas Nine, which is Kate and Jerry McCann and their friends, their doctor friends, they've never done a reconstruction. They've their police statements changed. There was problems with Jerry even remembering how he accessed the apartment. I've been to the scene of crime twice. You wouldn't forget. The two entrances are so, they're so at such a distance from each other. One is up a flight of steps. The other is where you have to go around the back of the apartment to be able to access it. And I just find it astonishing that a man whose child has gone missing couldn't even remember how he accessed the apartment during the time when she was reported, you know, reportedly taken. So there's all the, there's so many things. That's like one. There's so many things. We're talking, I think at the last count, I had like 89 question marks over the story. We're talking phenomenal things that don't add up. And it is actually phenomenal. People have reached more than that. I know somebody who came up with a list of 115 points that never added up about the case. So we are talking extensive. And I think what a lot of people object to, certainly in the UK, McCann Research in the UK really object to the Podesta story, because they truly believe, as do I, that the people there know what happened. This, of course, doesn't mean that there isn't more to it, that there weren't other people involved. You know, hypothetically speaking, the Podestas could have been there. They could have been part. We don't know that. What I'm saying is we haven't been able to source it. And I don't want people to take their eyes off of the people who were there, because I believe that they are the answer to this.
I really loved what you said about, you know, being that we take a position after, you know, doing research, investigating, yeah, going and asking questions, like you said, talking to the police, talking to sources, we come to conclusions. But of course, as you said, the very next day, if somebody provides information that sheds further light, that then, you know, gives us a new perspective, we remain open to that. That is what journalism is supposed to be about.
Absolutely.
And I really appreciate you saying that, because what I've noticed in relation to the Madeleine McCann case and the Podesta thing, but a number of different stories about Epstein, is that there are people who are doing their best out there as, say, YouTubers or just bloggers trying to get to the truth. And maybe some of them are doing so with the best intentions, maybe others purposely spreading disinformation and bad information. And there are people who come across that information, they watch a video, they read it, and they don't necessarily do their own critical thinking, and they just repeat that. And then these things become repeated. Somebody else reports on it, you know, gets talked and talked and talked. And it just becomes a part of the, you know, the sort of the lore, the mythology of the story. But there's not always a lot of fact checking. And so I've gone to specific lengths with the various Epstein piece of the puzzle to, you know, let's do a video answering that question that keeps popping up that people keep claiming. And it's the same thing with the sort of Podesta connection. And yeah. I do think that it could just be as simple as people sharing things without doing their own research, or somebody trying to muddy the waters, because from what I've seen, and it would make the most sense, the people that were there when Madeline disappeared would be the ones who probably have the most information. I mean, it just sort of makes sense. And like you said, that also still leaves open the possibility that, you know, there is some other larger network behind the scenes that
Absolutely.
We don't have information about, but we Absolutely. Don't have that information yet. So, you know, it's the people who want to speculate can speculate, but those who are, I believe, striving to remain true to journalism will stick with the facts until we have further yeah. data on that.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. And that's vital. And I don't sway. Once I know something, I'll stick with it until something. But and that's what information is, isn't it? That's what intelligence is being prepared to re-examine a situation subject to new information. I mean, that is surely all that we can ask of ourselves, you know, is not to keep a fixed position if there's a reason not to. And I think also, while I think that there is misinformation about Podestas, and I think that that does serve agendas for certain people, I think it goes back to the comment that you made earlier, which I think is a really important one. And that is, some things need almost, people think they need to be almost glamorized up, right? And it's like the Podesta angle to the McCann story seems to add a bit more international glamour for some people, a bit more intrigue. But the story itself, trust me, is intriguing enough. We really don't need to jazz it up. And that's always my position on news, is that oftentimes the truth is explosive enough. You really don't need to make it more than what it is. And in fact, the moment that you make it more than what it is, you lose the vital elements, you know, and it's the truth which is so compelling to people, and people feel it. Just this conversation that we're having now, people will feel the energy that we're sharing, because that's what the truth is. You know, it creates its own energy. Whereas people also know in their gut instinct, in their solar plexus, when they're being sold something that's a bit duff, right? And for me, as I say, the Podesta story has never panned out. My mind is open. If you've got some information, please contact me. I will pursue it.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's move on now to, and again, I'm going to link to your YouTube channel, and I encourage everybody to check out her playlist of all the films that she's put together, as well as her other reports. And I'll put a link to brand new to where they can find you and Sean on Saturday nights, right?
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, great. So I want you guys to check all that out, but also something that relates to, I feel really, it's connected to the work that I've been doing over here for a number of years on Epstein and the Finders and, you know, many of the American kind of network of pedophile activity and human trafficking. And what you're working on is from the other side. And it's clearly a similar story. A number of high profile people connected to pedophiles over decades of time, cover ups, you know, misreporting, you know, false reporting, lack of reporting, all of these same things. And that is sort of the basis for your work, not only in the documentary, but other reports you've done with pedophiles in Parliament. Go ahead and tell us all about that and what got you started on that.
Well, Pedophiles in Parliament was published 2 years ago, but continues to be a problem for me. In fact, I have a pending lawsuit. Because I think out of all the, well, not all, I've how many documentaries have I made? Maybe 5 or 6. It's one of the most controversial because it's evidence-based. I set out to do Pedophiles in Parliament because I was absolutely aware. Actually, let me go back to the beginning. So 2012 was when all the big revelations came out over here about Jimmy Savile. And Jimmy Savile, British entertainer, friend of royalty, friend of politicians, spent probably 10 to 12 Christmases at Chequers, which is the Prime Minister's residence. You don't get to spend that amount of time with the Prime Minister unless you've been super checked by the Secret Services. Jimmy Savile, it came out, was a prolific paedophile, but not just a paedophile, a Satanist. He was a necrophiliac. This was a man who was so influential in British establishment and high society that when Charles and Diana's marriage was falling apart, the Queen called Jimmy Savile in to be a mediator between Charles and Diana. So we're not talking about somebody who's just your regular person. Jimmy Savile, a DJ from the north of England, was also called in to have talks with Israel to do with government matters. Very bizarre behavior, again, for a DJ from the north of England, okay? So this was a man who had huge links to, as I say, the British establishment, both political and royal. And I had a lot of problems with the story because it was just basically portrayed when the story came out about Jimmy Savile, it was following his death. And I had a lot of problems with it because it basically sought to portray it to me in a certain light. And that was, it's the same thing again, Derek, and I know this will resonate with you. And that was, oh, Jimmy Savile, he was a bit of a baddie, but he really only went after, like, you know, 15, 16 year old girls who were already in trouble anyway and were already problematic. And that's how they sought to portray him. Not that I would think that was okay either, because a 15, 16 year old girl to me is still a child and abuse is abuse. But they hoped it would have that sort of Clinton effect, that if they use an older person, it takes it away from any suggestion of child abuse in any way. And that was how Jimmy Savile was portrayed initially when the revelations came out about him. And I talked with my producers and editors and said, this is only half the story. I've heard stories about him having keys to major hospitals where he was accessing the morgues and going and having sex with dead bodies. I said, there's something really wrong here. He's being protected by the establishment. And all my producers and editors said, yeah, we've heard that for years and nobody had done anything about it. So I thought, okay, we've got to do something a bit more about paedophiles, about the issue to do with paedophiles. And so after that Jimmy Savile revelation, an MP called Tom Watson, who had exposed the Murdoch empire and what was going on to do with politicians and the media, stood up in the House of Parliament and addressed David Cameron, who was the then Prime Minister, and said there had been long-term rumours existing that there had been a paedophile, or an influential paedophile, around Number 10 and around Parliament. And David Cameron promised there and then to investigate it. Well, to this day, there has been no convictions with regard to that. There's been a separate conviction recently, which was to do with an MP called Eric Joyce, but that was only because he was found to have a film on his computer, which he'd been accessing for 5 years, and which it's just awful. It's a minute, just under a minute film, contains about seven children. The oldest is about 7 years old, the youngest about 12 months, and they're being raped. And that was an MP called Eric Joyce. He's not actually in the film because that's only just come to light, and paedophiles in Parliament was 2 years ago. But that's the only conviction. The fact is that for decades, there have been paedophiles that have been around the British Parliament in positions of high authority, including around Margaret Thatcher, who was obviously a British Prime Minister for many years. And she was not only great friends with Jimmy Savile, but Sir Peter Morrison, who was her sort of number two. She was told by her protection officer that he was having weekend parties with young boys. And not only did she not investigate it, she promoted him. So that was quite clear that the most senior politician in British Parliament, Margaret Thatcher at the time, had no care about tackling the issue of paedophiles. She surrounded herself with paedophiles. And when she found out about them, she promoted them. So I was like, OK, there's something really wrong here. And then it turned out that Lord McAlpine, who was the chair of her party, the Conservative Party, was also accused of being a paedophile. And it was just all of it just came all coming together. And you know what it's like, Derek, once you start to probe, it's like the universe says, I like what you're doing there. I'm going to open up some more information for you. And it was a happening. And then it became this roller coaster of information. And I was taking it to editors and producers and saying, we have a documentary here. And they were like, no, we can't, because that involves like former, you know, senior politicians like Leon Britton and Lord Janner. These are very, very senior British politicians. They're now dead. They were allowed to die before they were properly investigated. Some were investigated, not all. But my editors were saying to me, no, you can't. And I was saying, but there's enough information in the public domain for us to actually form a legitimate inquiry. And they were saying, no. And that was when I started to see even deeper. I work with very good people, but they're still they're still surrounded, as you know, by an apparatus whereby politicians and media are still far too close, and there's still problems, obviously. So I said, sod it, I'm going to do it myself. So I actually taught myself how to use an iMovie at that time, before I'd moved over to Final Cut Pro X. My daughter helped me, being the, you know, being Gen Z, she completely understood all technology, was able to help me. She did music, we got, you know, help with graphics and all of this. And I put together this film called Paedophiles in Parliament. 2 years ago it was published, and as I say, the headaches are ongoing. On the day it was published, I received two threats of a lawsuit, and withstood it, and they went away, and I've got another current one, and all of it is evidence-based. And what I basically did was I linked up the relationships between the British press, British police, politicians over the decades, right up until present day, as much as I could, about how people had, one case, for example, Lord Janner. That was shocking to me. Now he's dead, died about a year and a half ago. 33 people came forward and said that he was going into their care homes in Leicester, which is like Middle England, and abusing them for years. And when it came to the rumours of this, he was given what was known as parliamentary privilege, which I don't know if this happens in America, but in the UK Parliament, if a politician has an issue hanging over them, they are allowed to stand up in the British Parliament, defend themselves, and or discuss any topic, but some of them use it to clear themselves, defend themselves, and they are not allowed to be questioned. And it goes down in the official records. And this is what Lord Janner did. He used the opportunity of parliamentary privilege to stand up and say, these rumours are about me, are all false. He was backed up by an existing MP called Keith Vaz, who had been very good friends with Janner's child in Leicester. Keith Vaz said, this is terrible what's being said about him. Keith Vaz, I follow throughout Paedophiles in Parliament because he has a very interesting history. When one police force started an investigation into Sir Edward Heath, who was also a British prime minister, who was rumoured to be taking young boys onto his boat off Jersey, raping them, cutting their throats and throwing them over the side. And David Icke said this in his book before Edward Heath died. And David Icke told me this directly. I worked with David Icke for a period of time. And David Icke put this in his book about Edward Heath. Before Edward Heath died, Edward Heath was informed about it and didn't legally pursue David Icke, did nothing about these allegations about him. And then when he died, years after, a police force, Wiltshire police force, had heard so many rumours, so many allegations, they decided to do an investigation. And Keith Vaz was one of the MPs who wrote to the chief constable and tried to get this investigation into Edward Heath stopped. So Keith Vaz was of great interest to me because he's like an MP. When people look him up, surname Vaz, V-A-Z, when people who are unfamiliar with him look him up, they will see he's an MP who's like considered, you know, cleaner than clean. He runs standard committees for the British Parliament, but he needs to be investigated. And I repeatedly say this, what we do know about Keith Vaz, because he was exposed on a Sunday tabloid, was that he has a taste for young Eastern European male prostitutes. We know that about him, but there are many rumours about him that should be investigated. I make no allegations against him. I'm just saying that there are sufficient rumours that should be investigated. But what I say clearly in Paedophiles in Parliament is this is a man who has a history of getting in the way of paedophile allegations against very senior members of Parliament. So he's one example. So Paedophiles in Parliament really is about a major cover-up that's taken place in the UK, certainly for the last 40 years. It involves children who were taken from their care homes, vulnerable children who were put into care because their parents were junkies, alcoholics, or just coming from difficult backgrounds like me, really. My sister was put in care, for example. Nothing happened to her, thank goodness, but a similar background. And these children were trafficked to locations in London, from North Wales, from all over England. Some of these boys were 7, 8 years old, dressed up as fairies, taken to parties with paedophile MPs, paedophile lords, paedophile lawyers, paedophile judges, raped and abused, passed around, and nobody was doing anything about it. And so I wanted to cover all that in Paedophiles in Parliament and put it down on the record. But it clearly had quite an impact because, as I say, I've had a number of legal attacks on it. And to actually have a legal attack on it 2 years after it was published tells you that people want that taken down. They want it taken down because it includes lots of information, including, for example, I went and met Dr. Joan Coleman. Dr. Joan Coleman died shortly after I met her. She was accused of being involved in satanic panic in the 80s and 90s in the UK. They tried to demonize that woman. They tried to demonize her because she was the person who was taking the testimonies from these children who were being taken to her because their parents thought these children were mad. These children were getting caught up in all manner of things by members of the family, some of them involved in Freemasons, some of you know, children, uncles were taking them to be raped and abused, aunties were taking them to be raped and abused, and the parents were like, why is my child sounding insane, saying insane things? So Dr. Joan Coleman was the doctor that all of them, you know, her reputation started to precede her. People started to see that this was a woman who not only was completely equipped to deal with what was being told but had an understanding of it, and she formed this thing called the Raines List, which is available online. I do not know the veracity of the Raines List. I talked to Dr. Joan Coleman about it. And the Raines List is pages and pages of very famous people who Dr. Joan Coleman said that her patients, very young patients, had named them. And Joan wouldn't include anybody on the Raines List unless they had been independently verified by a number of her patients. And we are talking about people who, politicians, media people, royalty, you know, lords and ladies, you name it. And so, and Joan is in the documentary, and that was a bit of a coup because the fact that she was prepared to see me, and because nobody could really get to her, but she'd heard enough about me to know that I was legit, that I had a legitimate inquiry. I wasn't going to demonize her. And the thing that happened with Joan is that they set out to demonize her, and they did very well for like the 80s and 90s when they said what she was saying. And when I say they, massive headlines, an inquiry, like the establishment went after this woman. And what was great was when I met her, she had been validated. There had been a new study which said that actually what she was talking about was real. It was legitimate. And so it turned around, but it took decades for it to turn around for her. And they went after her. I mean, her and her partner moved to a place called the Surrey Hills because people would turn up at their doorstep, you know, threatening her. Because that she was speaking out against the establishment. So that's paedophiles in Parliament, really. It's a big picture in the round of the history of paedophile accusations in the British Parliament for the last 40 years.
It's just a fantastic piece of work, gathering information. Just a fantastic piece of journalism. I really, really, we will link to it. I highly recommend everybody watching the documentary. Do you have it backed up on other channels in case, you know?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. And I would like to say, because it's really important, a piece of work like Paedophiles in Parliament is not just down to me. I mean, I get so many brilliant, brilliant people coming to me. You know what it's like, Derek, that once you open up, good people, all manner of people come to you, but good people come to you with information. And that a lot of that information from Paedophiles in Parliament, as I say, the universe opening up, when it became clear that I was serious and I was going to investigate it, people were coming to me and saying, okay, I've kept this for 12 years, you can have it now. And I was like, what? And it was just this amazing information that was coming to me because people knew that I was serious, that I wasn't a shill, that I wasn't establishment hack. And so I was very grateful that I could not have done it without the help of all of these incredible people, including online bloggers who have done such incredible work in the area of paedophilia. Incredible work. I mean, I'm just so grateful, so grateful.
Absolutely. It always comes down to really being a collaborative effort of so many people just sharing their information. One question I have on Paedophiles in Parliament before we wrap up is, did you find any connections to, you know, MI6 or other intelligence agencies? Oh, yeah. In a way we have over here in the US with CIA and other agencies involved?
Oh, absolutely. Unquestionably. In fact, I have an agent, a former Secret Service agent in Paedophiles in Parliament. And what became absolutely clear and apparent was how child abuse, the rape of children, was used as a currency. British Secret Services have hidden the rape of children. Cyril Smith was a politician in the north of England. He raped children, again, was going into care homes, as you know. And this is the thing, these politicians were allowed to act like the savior of their district, of their locality, and they were being given complete free rein to go into these care homes with these children already from very dysfunctional, broken homes and further make them vulnerable. And Cyril Smith was a perfect example of a cover-up of the establishment. He was raping and abusing children at a care home in the north of England called Knowle View, and schools, and Secret Services covered it up. But not only Secret Services, Lord David Steele, who was the head of, who was at the time ran the Liberal Democrats Party, Cyril, he went to Cyril Smith and said, "I've heard all these rumours about you." And Cyril Smith didn't deny it, and David Steele assumed it was true, did nothing about it. And that came out at our child abuse inquiry over the last year. But the Secret Services covered up Cyril Smith's abuse of children. They hid it. There's no doubt about that. And there is also no doubt about the fact that children have been used as blackmail currency by the Secret Services. And it's one way, it's international, this is an international trade, disgustingly, but it has been frequently used. So, for example, if a politician is really, well, if a particular party is really keen on pursuing certain laws and they need international cross-border cooperation, then children have been used, the abuse of children, footage from the abuse of children has been used as a blackmail over, you know, enforcing that cross-border cooperation between countries. That has happened, and the Secret Services are complicit in that.
Yeah, it's just more information to add to the disturbing reality that we live in. But of course, yeah, this is the job of journalists and investigators to get out there to try to give, again, these people a voice, because the way I feel is disturbing as all of this is, and it is absolutely disturbing. And, you know, the things I found with the Finders cult over here and the CIA involvement and all this, just so much going on. The way I think about it is, if we don't have the courage and, you know, the stomach to go through this information and to investigate it, then the reality is that these children were abused and nothing is going to be done about it. I mean, if we can't stomach hearing about it, think about how these people had to live through it is sort of where I always try
that
to...
That is literally my position. My position is exactly that. And that is, me listening to it is nothing compared to you enduring it. So if I can't reach across the aisle to you in some way, then what is wrong with me? And that is exactly my position. You know, yes, some of this is horrible, and I have to be very, very, very careful these days how much I take in, because there was a point where you stare too long into that void, it starts to stare back at you, and I, you know, into that darkness. And it took me down for a period of time, I'll be absolutely honest with you. From about 2013, maybe to about 2017, I was linked up to, I had a panic alarm which linked me up to the Metropolitan Police under their insistence, because the death threats I was receiving were so astonishing that they couldn't guarantee my safety. And so they put me on a panic alarm, which when we moved home, I said to them, you have to take it now, because the problem about a panic alarm is it makes you panic. And I do still have stalkers who threaten to murder me, set me on fire, rape me, all manner of things. They are linked up to paedophiles. Certainly one of my main stalkers was involved in the gang rape of a child in a care home. We have to, you know, I don't feel we actually have a choice. It's like, to me, this isn't a career, it's a calling. So seeing as I've been blessed with that, because it's an honour, I'd rather all of this vanished. I'd rather the abuse of children never happened again. But that's ridiculous. We know that's not the case. We know we have an international child abuse problem. And it's only by saying, okay, we've got to do something about it. And that period of time when it took me down, I was really, really ill. At one stage, I had 17 sicknesses wrong with my body, because obviously, you know how it works. And that is, obviously, I take much better care of myself these days. I make sure that my immune defenses are up and all of those things. But at that time, it just kind of took me down, and I literally had everything. My body was like falling apart, because it was impacting me so deeply in my heart and in my psychology that the only way it could be released was through my body. But I've learned to strengthen up since then, and certainly not easily scared. I have a fantastic support system around me. But I just believe that when our time's up, our time is up, and we just do as much good as we possibly can on this earth while we can. And that's my mission. And it's that simple.
And I think that's a wonderful mission. And if we could have more people dedicated to that mission of trying to do something good here, then I think we'd be in a better position, right? And I really commend you, Sonia, for all the work that you're doing and all the work that you have done. I cannot recommend everybody listening to this to please watch her documentaries and support her work. Where's the best place for people to link up with you? Is it YouTube or your website or...
Yeah, certainly on YouTube. I have two different platforms on YouTube. I have the one which has all my documentaries and the other which has all my mainstream work. And even if people choose to go on the mainstream one, they'll see that I never, ever talk mainstream talk. I get in terrible trouble because I never stick to the script or prearranged argument on the debate or whatever. And I always aim on mainstream platforms just to push that envelope a little bit more, just so that there's a little bit more insight for people, that they're not going round and round in the same old slush puddle, really. But yeah, YouTube is a great place. www.soniapoulton.co.uk is my website, which links up to all my work, my written work, my radio work, my TV work, my internet work. I'm on Twitter and I'm on Instagram. I closed my Facebook account last December. I had enough of that. I hate Facebook.
That's a good move.
Yeah, I really miss the people though, because then that's where they get you, obviously, is you form these friendships, don't you? That you don't know these people on any other platforms other than these platforms. And I miss a lot of people, but thankfully some people have caught me on Twitter now, which I find just a lot easier. It's like basically you shoot it out, and because obviously on Facebook people have to friend you and all of that kind of stuff, and whereas on Twitter you shoot it out and it can get out to a much wider public. So
I totally understand that. Yeah, it's these connections are important. So hopefully those of you who follow her work will link up either on Twitter or through her website. Again, thank you so much, Sonia Poulton, for your work,
thank
for
you.
Joining us
thank
today
you.
And just I look forward to collaborating with you in the future.
Absolutely, because I feel exactly the same way about you as well, Derek. I commend you in exactly the same way. You know, you and I are just sort of different sides of the coin. You're in over there, I'm over here, but we're still up against the same enemies, same demons. They're linked together. We know that the Epstein case is proof positive of that, because obviously Prince Andrew, royal family, Epstein. So absolutely, I look forward to working with you in future. Definitely, Derek, thank you for all you do.
Thank you for your time. All right, everyone, till next time, this has been Derek Brose, The Conscious Resistance. Please look up Sonia, and remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free.
Absolutely.